So I'm Rick Hansen. This is December 16th, 2015. And I want to pick up on some of the things we've talked about in the last several weeks and sort of open it up more. So I'll hold forth here very briefly just to kind of reset us or rewind us a little. So in the last several times we've been together, I have focused on one of the three great pillars of practice in the Buddhist tradition, which, and these three pillars can be found in other traditions as well, including the Christian tradition in whose space we're standing here tonight or sitting here tonight. The three great pillars in the language of early Buddhism, Pali, are said to be sila, samadhi, and panya. Sila, translated generally as virtue, restraint, morality, you know, wholesome conduct. Non-harming is the essence of sila, including non-harming oneself. So we have sila, the virtue dimension, the moral dimension of practice. Okay. Then we have the second pillar, samadhi. That word itself literally means, you know, non-ordinary states of deeply absorbed, concentrated, often blissful consciousness. The more general meaning has to do with the mindfulness and concentration aspects of practice, which are very experiential. The samadhi pillar of practice is about opening to experience and cultivating certain kinds of experiences. Experiences of steadiness of mind, of tranquility, of joy, of bliss, of compassion, of loving kindness for others, wholesome experiences, a kind of lusciousness of landing in the body. That's the samadhi pillar. And then we have the third pillar of practice, panya, or wisdom, insight, wise view. The eightfold path is divided into those three groups. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. That's in the virtue umbrella. Okay. Then we have, in terms of samadhi, we have right mindfulness, right concentration, or right effort. And then in terms of wisdom, we have right view and right intention. It's roughly how those are categorized. So you see they fit, right? Okay. How most people, I think, on the whole, regard Buddhism is in terms of the first and third. There's the bit about not harming, be nice, don't hurt others, nonviolence, that gets extended toward a kind of a stewardship orientation of the planet altogether, not killing other animals, the virtue pillar, and the wisdom pillar, the panya pillar. Tends to get really emphasized, the Dharma, the wise view, you know, how to think about things, right? And both of those are really important, obviously, but they can lead to a certain prunishness, a certain dried upness, if you will, you know, around, oh, I got to behave correctly, et cetera, and I have to see things the right way, top down, okay? And yet there's this really central pillar, samadhi pillar of practice, which is very experiential. It's coming into your experiencing and leaning into those experiences moment to moment, because that's what we are. We are experiencing. We are experiences. We are phenomenology unfolding. Okay, leaning into wholesome experiences and disengaging from unwholesome ones and deepening that resting in what's wholesome. And what is wholesome? It's not just disengaging from suffering. It's engaging happiness, peace. Of the, you know, seven factors of awakening. One is bliss or rapture. Another one is tranquility. Those are really pleasurable. Concentration is another one of the seven factors. Those are very positive. You know, Buddhism is not a bummer, dour, glum thing, even though many people have characterized as that. Proper practice is joyful, peaceful, juicy and rested in the body. And I think, honestly, my own view is that if for some, you know, like time machine, reverse time thing, you know, if we had made all the abbots of all the monasteries during the 2,500 year history of Buddhism women, I think there would have been much more appreciation for the samadhi pillar of practice. It's a personal opinion. So just it's that lusciousness, that's that embodied aspect of practice. Okay? Rather than a more austere morality and philosophy. Okay? So far? So was that pretty interesting stuff. And then we talked about different kinds of embodied experiencing and facing the ways in which we tend to be up in our heads. I definitely could speak to that, certainly my history. And also often can be, you know, hard on ourselves or unwilling to give ourselves the gift of the lusciousness of this felt moment. Right? And then we also talked about some of the key experiences that are really helpful. You know, happiness is a factor of awakening, in a sense. Joy and contentment. Also, you know, a willingness to experience just the happiness of not driving, not pressuring, not attaching, not fighting, not struggling. It's a happiness. And last time I talked about, you know, this wonderful, for me, summary kind of admonition or instruction from the teacher, the Buddha, as best we know. He says, be still and know the sweet joy of the way. And I especially focused on the second of that. So I want to pause and just see what questions or comments you have about any of that material, you know, or really anything else. And as we slide into the new year, I'm also interested in getting a read on, you know, just kind of where are you in your practice? What's going well for you? What's perhaps problematic? Or what, you know, is your sense of the next step that's becoming available for you that you're not quite sure how to grow into or live into as fully as you'd like, perhaps? Okay? Okay. So, any questions or comments about the samadhiness, experiencing, Buddhism as experiential practice, positive experiences, emotionally positive experiences, etc.? Bill?
If some of you have heard this before, I got a ticket and I went to traffic school in order to avoid it being on my record. And I took one of these traffic schools. It was a really straightforward opportunity to learn something about driving. It wasn't one of the comedy, laugh your ass off traffic school. It was actually traffic school. What I learned in that was what it means to stop. When you stop at a stop sign, your momentum takes you forward, and then you get a little kick in the back. That means you've stopped. So if you do that, you get a lot of things out of it. You get the bliss of blamelessness because you're actually driving legally. I would say that. Likely, we will. Most of us will not do that on the way home tonight. But now you can because of what I'm suggesting you do. This has opened up enormous, valuable insight to me. I get this. I've talked about this before in other forums. It reminds me of everything, the allness that we're a part of, and it brings a spark of joy to do that. Now, this really worked for me.
Now, thank you.
I have other answers for other questions later, but that's my first.
That's great.
I recommend.
And that's so experiential, what you're saying. Yeah.
It's bodily.
Yeah.
It's a nudge. It's a little nudge.
Thank you. All right. Yeah.
So you were talking about self-consciousness before as in kind of a pejorative sense. And so then there's self-awareness.
Right.
So how do you play with that? Is that meaningful?
And that's a deep question. So I was talking about self-consciousness and, you know, and some of the costs of it. It's beneficial. It helps us function skillfully, you know, in groups, right? Whether it's hominid bands in the Serengeti or, you know, junior high school, right? Self-consciousness can be adaptive or many jobs. But it has pitfalls, and I was just kind of calling out a recognition of the pitfalls. And the pervasiveness of self-consciousness, and especially a lot of people, me included, feel if we could be less self-conscious, it would probably net be good, you know, so that part. But yeah, and then how do you have self-awareness without self-consciousness? And where it gets interesting to me is just the language tends to shove us into certain presumptions. You know, like language of gender tends to shove us into certain presumptions that are binary, and is gender really binary, and all the rest of that. And why do we add the word self-awareness? Right? There's awareness. There is phenomenology. I mean, that was what was so radical about the Buddha. He didn't presume anything. He started from the ground up, from the most granular, deconstructed aspects of what was there, which is experience, right? And so, can there be awareness, okay, of, I mean, there's awareness, right? There's experience occurring, and in a loose sense, what we are aware of is regarded as, you could say, external to us. I'm aware of your face, I'm aware of the light, you know, I hear sounds rustling, okay? And then there's awareness that in some of the other objects in awareness are, you know, intangible sensations, and feelings, and they're more internal, as well as thoughts, desires, and so forth. So can there be awareness, right, without presuming that there's an entity who is aware? Right? And, you know, can there be subjectivity? Because there is a subjectivity inherent in experiencing. You know, where experiences occur in relationship to an experience, to a particular perspective, particular body, there's a subjectivity inherent in experience. But those moments of subjectivity that are inherent in ordinary experience, that the brain indexes across and finds that which is enduring, that which is unchanging, you know. The brain infers a subject from moments of subjectivity, but is there actually really a subject inside? So what the Buddha did is he brought it really down to experience. He was so experiential, and that's kind of what I want to emphasize. How experiential is your practice? How in your experience are you? And how, you know, what's your relationship to your own experience, and how skillful are you with regard to your experience? It's a really fundamental question. So I guess that would be some reflections on what you're bringing up. And I think oftentimes people develop such a heightened self-awareness, unfortunately sometimes in meditative environments, or they're so self-aware, they're like the proverbial millipede that could no longer walk when you asked it, which leg are you going to move next, you know? Or that really awkward teenager who's going to ask somebody else out on a date and just can't do it because they're so self-conscious. Like, there are extremes of self-awareness that I think are problematic. And people have critiqued this in terms of mindfulness training, because mindfulness can be taken as, I'm going to develop this super sophisticated, you know, skillful subject who's really continually aware of the movie going by, right? Which just reinforces that notion of there being an entity inside, which is problematic, and creates a dualistic split between, you know, observer and observed, subject and object. And that can be a kind of a problem of too much mindfulness training of a certain kind, or it can go there. And I think where it is really helpful is to keep bringing it down to what is there. There are experiences, and experiences seem to have a quality of consciousness or awareness, and then things moving or arising and disappearing or persisting in awareness, and leaving it at that, and then seeing what that's like. And what happens, interestingly, as people move more and more, you know, into experience, right, just into awareness, gently guided by virtue and wisdom. Right, just going into experience without virtue and wisdom is a prescription for disaster. Right, we need, maybe it's a little bit like the banks of a river. You know, we need something to flow through if we're going to be experiential. But when people go more and more in their experiences, you may well have discovered increasingly, things become less problematic. You know, there's more connectedness with everything. You know, it feels better and better. It's more and more peaceful, less and less struggle. A little nudging from the moral side occasionally, a little comment from the insight, wisdom side occasionally. You know, it reminds me of this line from Nisargadatta, which is, I'll finish on this point. He is a great non-dual teacher in India, Sri Nisargadatta. He said, wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. And between these two banks, the river of my life flows. We'll just stop right there and marinate in that one for the next 20 minutes. Yeah. And obviously around experiencing, there are pitfalls. If we start clinging to pleasant experiences, that's a pitfall. If we criticize ourselves because we're not able to drop into that sweet, tranquil, embodied zone we were in yesterday or earlier today, and that's a pitfall. But just because they're pitfalls doesn't mean we don't walk on the path. We just try to stay out of the pits. Okay? Yeah. All right.
Regarding letting go of thoughts,
yeah.
I find it easier said than done.
And okay.
Especially if something really ugly is sort of happening in my life, I sort of measure it by how many times I pull myself back from the same little whatever. And sometimes, you know, it's just like focusing on your, pulling yourself back, focusing on the present moment. But sometimes there's a theme there, and I can't get out of it unless I dig down a bit, you know what I mean? Like, figure out what's going on. And I'm just wondering if you have any guidelines for when you need to look deeper for what's pulling you off and when it's just like pull yourself back. Do you understand my question?
I think so.
Okay.
Well, two things. So first, I'm still reflecting slightly on what got brought up. In terms of self-awareness, if we just take it as awareness, and then there's what are you aware of? Okay, maybe I'm aware of the two trucks next to me driving down the freeway, or maybe I'm also aware of the anxiety in my belly because my kid's in the back seat, right? What are you aware of? And then in terms of this question, I think there's a lot of self-awareness that is useful, is deconstructing our experience into its elements. I think of it as the horizontal and the vertical dimension of experience. You know, horizontally, what are the threads? You know, for example, the Buddha thought in terms of what is the bare sensations and experience, what's the sense of it as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, you know, how are we labeling it, you know, what's our sense of categorizing things in our experience, what else is going on in the mind, and awareness itself, kind of the five aggregates. Or you could, you know, pull apart your experience, what are the body sensations here? What are the longings here, the wants? What are the beliefs here? What are the emotions? Like, that's another way to do it. And then vertically, what's younger, softer, more fundamental, more vulnerable, more at the heart of the matter, underneath it, deeper and deeper and deeper, down to the tip of the root, okay? And what I find when I do that myself, and I think when other people do it too, the feeling, the experience, the sense of kind of burrowing down, peering down, really trying to, I liken it to a little bit, you're sitting there in the stream of consciousness and a leaf rolls by and you go, or you hear a loud thud and suddenly you feel different and there's a leaf next to you and you pull on the leaf, you know, next to your little canoe, and then you get a twig, you keep pulling on the twig, you get a branch, you pull on the branch, and you finally get to the trunk of the tree that whacked your canoe and made you feel suddenly kind of slumping and sleepy and depressed when that male authority figure looked at you, you know, with a kind of glared at you. It's like, see what I mean? And that feeling of sensing down, sensing into, opening to what's younger in there, has an impersonal feeling to it. It feels kind of impersonal. It's just what's there. You know, no praise, no blame, just the facts, what's there. And the sense of it for me is very different from self-conscious, narcissistic preoccupations, do you like me, or feeling embarrassed about something, or, you know, ashamed of myself about something. Those self-conscious emotions feel different from the self-awareness that's the investigation factor of awakening. And letting it be kind of impersonal, it's just what's there. And it's there for a reason. We're social mammals, we have childhoods, we have parents, life happens, right? Okay, right? And I'm hoping that you're doing a lot of investigating down into your experience, right? Okay, so how do you know whether to, you know, go more deeply into it or just kind of pull out? I think it depends kind of on your purpose and also your nature and what works for you, and there's different advice. A lot of people, you know, kind of classically meditative teachers, it's said in a way, you know, the porcupine knows only one thing, but that one thing it knows really, really well. You know, this it's quills, its spine, its little stickers. Okay. I think many meditation teachers, especially like from Southeast Asian traditions, know one thing really well, which is let it go, let it go, let it go. Disengage, disidentify, just be mindful, just be with it. Notice unpleasant, notice unpleasant, notice unpleasant, you know? And that's an incredibly powerful tool. Now, if you've got 20, 30 years of practice, 24 hours a day, in a contained environment, it can be really, really fruitful. And I think for some people, it's very fruitful. And it's our last resort. So for me, it's the foundational practice to just be with what's there, accepting it, bearing it, staying with it, you know, hopefully with healthy factors like not identifying with it, getting some distance from it, you know, having compassion for yourself about it and so forth. Okay. But there are other tools in the toolbox than just notice unpleasant, notice unpleasant, notice pleasant, notice neutral, notice unpleasant, you know. And so for myself, I am not interested in being beset by things routinely. And I think of the language of the Buddha where he talked about his own run-up to awakening, his own kind of launch. And toward the end of that launch, you know, what really characterized like the pre-launch phase, and he's just talking about his own experience, is he said, you know, I experienced all these painful, painful things because he was doing a lot of austerities and ascetic practices, at least the account says he was doing that. He said, I was experiencing all these unpleasant things, presumably also sometimes pleasant ones, but nothing invaded my mind and remained. So as soon as I'm tracking that something's invading my mind and remaining, that's yellow, orange, red flag. Whether it's chasing some positive pleasure, because I'm fairly pleasure-seeking, or it's obsessively worrying about something negative, concerning, like my wife does, because she's more worried about that kind of thing, right? Or maybe it's obsessing about something interpersonally. Why hasn't he called me back, right? Or what do I think they thought about that, right? Okay, see what I'm saying? So does it invade the mind and remain? And then there is this, there's this great, I should bring it in one time because it's quite striking. There's this sutra that's about, in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's about six strategies for distracting thoughts, okay? And it goes through six ways of dealing with things besides just be with it, be with it, be with it, be with it, right? And the last one has this language that's really aggressive in it. You know, he says, if all else fails, grab hold of that problematic, you know, thought or feeling or desire and wrestle it to the ground, you know, literally. And it's like, whoa, the Buddha's like a wrestler, like, whoa, you know, literally like a strong man when takes someone and, you know, push him to the ground. You know, like literally, it has that kind of language to it. So there's a range of practice, you know, and finishing, it's a helpful thing for me to keep drilling down to what's the craving. So much of practice, in whether it's sila, samadhi, and panya, really is about, you know, craving or not craving. Right? And not craving can include passion, desire, aspiration, fieriness, seriousness, gravity, you know, resolve, delight. Doesn't mean we're craving, right? Like, it's okay to have desires that our kids learn to read, you know, and to be willing to be strong, to enforce virtuous desires, let's say. But you can feel it, that the essence of almost any upset is some kind of craving. If there's just a bad condition we can't change, it's just unpleasant. We have chronic pain, perhaps. Or our heart is deeply heavy because we've lost a loved one recently. Or we're just so upset or we're upset about how other people are being treated or conditions in the planet or, you know, environment or species extinction, whatever it might be. You know, we may well have painful, unpleasant experiences, but we can also reckon, we don't have to be upset about them. And if we're ever upset in some way, there's craving always at the heart of it. So I try to drill down to what is that craving and try to feel my way into experientially, what would it be like to not have it? Imagining the positive possible alternative, the wise, healthy, enlightened. What would Jesus do, right? What would the Buddha do? What would, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh do? What might be another person's relationship to that be? Flip the other way, my wife is very not self-conscious. She actually grew up in an incredibly healthy home. Damn it. So she doesn't understand me. But anyway, you know, and like how it, she wouldn't work. It was like, they were like that. She'd move on. Me, I'm like, how could they treat me that way? And maybe I did something wrong. And, you know, I'm like caught up in it a little bit. So it's cool to imagine how other people would do it, to find your way into the not craving experientially. What's the feeling of not being disturbed about this? These three words are really a finish for sure on this one. Have really present for me lately as practice: unthreatening, undisturbed, undefended. The feeling of being unthreatening with other people, right? Including subtleties of threat. Maybe it's not your intent to be threatening, but the impact given age, gender, status, height, physicality, depth of voice, who knows what? You know, the last things that have happened, unthreatening, and undisturbed in the mind. If there's any craving present, there's a disturbance. And then undefended. No need to be guarded, just whoosh. Think about the feeling of that. Unthreatening, undisturbed, undefended. And then what it feels like when all are present for at least a second in a row. And then you start stringing together more seconds, like pearls on a chain. Interpersonally, if it's an interpersonal upset, I never get free until I've done two things. Take personal, maximum reasonable personal responsibility for my part, which might be zero, but I'm willing to take whatever the maximum reasonable is that I, you know, unilaterally get to decide. And the other one is to find compassion for the other person. Then I could get my way down to, then if you think about it, there's not craving there. If you take maximum reasonable personal responsibility and have compassion, that eliminates a lot of craving, often all of it. And then you get free. Okay. Yeah.
Hi, Rick.
Yeah. Hi.
This subject of self-consciousness, I found that practicing Buddhism has helped me immensely overcome it.
Yeah.
But I often wonder self-consciousness is normal in certain situations with children as you're growing up and all of that. But I've always wondered what makes some people so self-conscious and other people have no self-consciousness. It seems to me it comes from your upbringing.
Yeah.
At least that's what happened to me. Yeah. But how does your upbringing affect your self-consciousness when you're older? And it also seems to me that older people lose their self-consciousness.
Yeah.
So it's a nice benefit of aging.
Yeah.
So I wonder what your thoughts on that are.
I'm developing some. In other words, it's a great question. I don't know, I have notions of an answer, and I'll be very brief about this. But I knew for myself that in my upbringing, I had to really monitor my internal states and what was leaking out to the world that my parents could take issue with. See? So I had to become self-conscious. Whereas my wife, I think in her environment, she just really didn't have to do that. She had ordinary self-awareness, a little bit as a teenage girl. You know, she wished she was a little thinner, but it wasn't a big deal for her, partly because she was so fueled by the completely unconditional, really chilled out, good parenting she got. So you're right. I think childhood really can affect it. I think people vary in their natural vulnerabilities or tendencies towards self-consciousness. And often what travels with self-consciousness are certain benefits. You know, it made me much better therapist because I'm really aware of my own processes, and then that helps me be aware of other people's processes. So that where it gets interesting is to more and more become freer and freer about it. Releasing negative self preoccupations. So let's name some major candidates. Okay, you don't have to show your hands for whether this fits you. Okay, one is negative self preoccupations. Okay, body appearance, major one for many people. I haven't done this. I screwed up with that. Way past the point that it's useful. I mean, get the learning from it, but once you get the learning, move on. Put in the correction and move on, you know? So, right? Negative self-preoccupation. Another one is getting really invested in what other people think about you. Okay, that, you know? And I think I'll just offer a last one, which I find a lot. It's an unfulfilled longing for cherishing, and that's not honored, right? Can you honor your longings, you know, especially unfulfilled, wholesome longings for cherishing, for narcissistic supplies, for prizing, for feeling wanted? There's a lot of self-consciousness that lives and is busy around that hole in the heart. Okay? I need to finish. I've actually gone long. I apologize. It's 36 after, 35 after. I'm happily stick around a little longer.
We should.
That wholesome longing. I think there can be craving for cherishing, prizing, you know, approval, admiration. I'm familiar with all of those, all those forms of craving. But there can also be a wholesome need for it or longing for it because we're social mammals, and being cared for and valued by others is innate to our nature. Just like it's innate to our nature to not want to rest our hand on a hot plate. Or it's innate to our nature to need water or oxygen. I think as social mammals, feeling prized, cherished, wanted, included, et cetera, is as necessary for our health of the mind and the heart as water is to the body. And often people, for every person who's intensely driven for narcissistic approval in a way that's really problematic, I think there are 20 people at least who are overly self-denying and even self-shaming of their natural needs for cherishing. And they also, or they're just passive and inert about not doing practical actions to increase the odds of getting those needs met. Thanks. All right. So, landing, opening, letting go. How about we sit with that for a minute and wrap it up, okay? Thank you very much. Thank you for your practice. One of the great gifts to others is your practice. See you next week, I hope.
Your course on Sunday online. Do they know about that?